Okay, so let's start the Q&A. So yesterday somebody asked about the verses that are found in the Majjhima Nikaya 128. And just to remind you, this is where the Buddha, after there's a quarrel between the monks, and after the quarrel the Buddha is kind of, he leaves and is a bit fed up with the monks obviously, and as he's about to leave he speaks these verses. And after that he goes out and he meets with some other monks who are practicing well, and he eventually he gives them a nice talk about the obstacles in meditation practice, and talks about his own obstacles and how he eventually reached awakening via jhana experience and all of that. But these particular verses that come at an early point in the sutta, they are also found in the Dhammapada. So this will give you some idea what the Dhammapada is like. Dhammapada is this book which is all verse, but not of inspiring verse in there. Yeah. So these are some of these verses. I think the first two here, they're not found in the Dhammapada, but the rest are here. Yeah. So this is how it goes. This is the Buddha kind of not being too happy with the monks. And he says, when many, many voices shout at once, none considers himself a fool. Though the Sangha is being split, none thinks himself to be at fault. They have forgotten thoughtful speech. They talk obsessed by words alone. Uncurbed, their mouths, they bawl at will. None knows what leads him so to act. He abused me, he struck me, he defeated me, he robbed me. In those who harbor thoughts like this, hatred will never be allayed. He abused me, he struck me, he defeated me, he robbed me. In those who do not harbor thoughts like these, hatred will readily be allayed. For in this world, hatred is never allayed by further acts of hate. It is allayed by non-hatred. This is a fixed and ageless law. Those others do not recognize that here we must restrain ourselves. But those wise ones who realize this, at once end all their enmity. If one can find a worthy friend, a virtuous, steadfast companion, then overcome all threats of danger, and walk with him content and mindful. But if one finds no worthy friend, no virtuous, steadfast companion, then as a king leaves his conquered realm, walk like a tusker in the woods alone. Better it is to walk alone. There is no companionship with fools. Walk alone and do no evil, at ease like a tusker in the woods. So that is the Buddha, first of all, talking about all these monks. Yeah, when many voices shout at once, when you kind of come together in a large group, often you become stupid, and you start acting like the group, and you forget to think about your own actions, because everyone is acting the same way. This is how you get this kind of mass suggestion. You see these football matches, and everyone is kind of jumping up and down at the same time. Everyone becomes really stupid sometimes. Then towards the very end, the Buddha is about to leave everyone, and then he says that there is no companionship with fools. So he walks out alone like a tusker, like an elephant, yeah, with big tusks, and he walks off into the forest, into the woods by himself. And most of these verses are actually found in the Dhammapada. They're very kind of nice. They're very simple little verses, but they kind of bring out the essence of so much in the Dhamma. It's enough to remind you, it only takes 2 minutes to read them, and it's enough to remind you of some of the important things in Dhamma practice. So very, very useful. Okay, anyway, so let's go on to the questions. Day 8, okay. Dear Arvinda Mali, is this an extract from your kind of your diary or something? We had day 8. Thank you for this amazing journey. My meditation is progressing well each time after the sutta class. Okay, that's good. Sitting initially for only 10 minutes to now 1 hour and 10 minutes. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And thank you to the fellow retreatants for loving kindness, radiating beautiful energy here. The death meditation is so powerful and profound, really powerful stuff. Thank you. Can we do this death meditation again? once again side to side for this awesome journey here. Good. I'm glad. That's very excellent that you have enjoyed the meditation retreat, and that's always a good sign. So keep on practicing, and you take it further and further and further. That's what this path is about. Death contemplation, probably not this year. I probably have to wait till next year, unfortunately, because it's getting a little bit too late now in the retreat to, I think, do another one of those. But there will be more retreats, so who knows when it's going to happen next time. So thank you for that very kind and nice message. Dear Ajahn, can a meditator experience different color of nimitta? For example, if he's doing anapanasati, he will see the white, bright nimitta. And if he's doing metta bhavana, he might see beautiful golden color nimitta. Thank you. As I understand it, it is possible to see these things with different colors. Because these things are basically mind-made things, and the mind can create pretty much everything. Mind is very creative. Everything that's created in the world comes ultimately from the mind. So yes, it is possible. So the most important thing about the nimitta is not so much what it looks like, but more what it feels like. And if it feels good, if it feels beautiful, if it feels joyous, if it feels peaceful, it has all good qualities, you know it's something good. And then you can focus on it if it is steady and you're ready. It is ready to be focused on. So it is more the feeling quality that matters much more than the actual visual quality. And this is why you see the Buddha, when he talks in the suttas about meditation, he always talks about feelings. He talks about the sequence of piti, sukha, pasadi, and all of that. It's all about the feelings that actually matter the most as far as meditation is concerned. Dear Ajahn, when practicing breath meditation, is it necessary to consciously move to the next stage? Once one is happy with one stage, or is it an automatic process controlled by mindfulness? Please explain that. It is a little bit of both, but ideally the process happens by itself. You just kind of sit back and allow things to be, and then each of these stages, it kind of comes by itself. But sometimes you may need, as I said before, a little bit of nudging, especially if you're watching the breath peacefully and there is no joy, for example, in the process. Sometimes you just need to nudge the mind a little bit, like give rise to a positive memory from the past, give rise to a kind of an idea of metta in your heart, just have a feeling of appreciation for all your fellow meditators, like this last note we had, thinking a bit like that, but not thinking so much, more like just bringing up a perception. It's a very gentle thing. Otherwise you destroy the meditation completely. But most of it, ideally, it is an automatic process. You just sit back and you allow it all to happen. But then if it doesn't work, then nudge it very gently in the right direction. Question number two. In a sutta done today, it was mentioned that a monk picked up a rag which was not specifically given to him. Is this okay? It depends. If the rag has another owner, you cannot just take it. But this is the rag on the roadside. It is a discarded rag. It's called pangsukula in Pali. Pangsukula means that it's from the dust heap. It is something discarded by others. So if you are confident that it doesn't have any other owner, then there is no problem. There was one story I forgot to mention today. So I tell this story at every retreat. Ananda knows already what it is. And this is a story where the monk thought that the rag had no owner, but he was slightly mistaken about that. And this is the case where the Raghura monk, he goes to the charnel ground where they burn all the corpses. And there was a corpse on the charnel ground. They are freshly thrown on the charnel ground, and usually they wrap the corpse in a bit of cloth. So the monk was really happy. Fresh corpse. Fresh corpses are much better than the old ones, because the rag is still not dirtied or stained by the smell and the disgusting things that comes from corpses after a while. So very happy. Fresh corpse. Take all the rags off this corpse and to use for his robe. But the corpse was a little bit too fresh. A smidgen too fresh. So as he's taking off this rag, the corpse says to him, "Don't take my rag." And the monk says, "Shut up, you're dead." Actually, he doesn't say that. He doesn't. That's just added for special effects. So the monk just doesn't care what the corpse is. It's a corpse. Yeah, what is it going to say? So it takes all the cloth off, and then taking all the cloth off, the corpse rises up, and starts walking behind him. And the monk looks over his shoulder, whoa, and he starts running. You're not supposed to run as a monk, but when you get a bit frightened, you run as a monk. And this is the origin of the zombies. It started in the monastic Vinaya. This is where it comes from. And the corpse runs after him, And so that's basically the story. And then the monk runs off and he gets into his little hut and he slams the door. And just as he slams the door, the corpse falls down on the outside. And from that story, there is a rule was laid down. This is kind of what the monastic rules are about. If you ever wonder what all these specialized rules for the monastics is about, this is one of those rules. And the Buddha said, from now on, you have to wait till the corpse is cold before you take the cloth from the corpse. That is one of the rules for monks, You have to wait till... It's kind of amazing. The rules that you find in the Vinaya are pretty kind of specialized. This is one of those super-duper specialized cases. So coming back to your question, you have to be a bit careful, Because sometimes there might be ownership there. The Buddha says a corpse doesn't really have ownership, so it doesn't really matter so much. But you should be, careful. So you can assume that if something is just abandoned by the roadside, it doesn't have any ownership, and then there is no problem with taking that rag. Okay. Question number one. In many suttas, it recommends you to develop the factors in the 37 Bodhipakkhadhammas based on seclusion, dispassion, cessation, maturing in release. Could you kindly explain how to understand this and how to practice this? Okay, I did mention it before, but maybe not clearly enough. I'm very happy to go over it again. The idea on, especially for the when it comes to the meditation parts of the 37 Bodhipakkhadhammas, that is where this particular instruction, you find this instruction. So for example, you find it with the 7 Bhojangas, because the 7 Bhojangas, the factors of awakening, are really all about meditation practice. Sometimes you also find it with the Noble Eightfold Path, because the end of the Noble Eightfold Path is also about meditation, not the beginning perhaps, but certainly the end. So that is usually where you find this. And the idea here is that real meditation practice, for it to really develop into the jhana states and deep samadhi and then eventually insight, to do that, the ideal condition for that is seclusion. So seclusion means, in the siddhas, there's two kinds of seclusion, the kaya viveka, the seclusion of the body, the Buddha often talks going to an empty hut, going to the forest, going to the root of a tree, in other words, being apart from other people. So jhana grove is not bad, it's quite good seclusion here. I think it's really nice that everyone has individual rooms. I think that's really, really good. And I think this is kind of much, much better than having a dormitory, as is very common in other retreat centers. This is far superior. So I'm really glad that when we built this retreat center, we did it properly. We didn't kind of mess around. So that is the first part. And of course, for monastics, it means staying in the kuti, ideally in isolation. The more forest kind of bound that kuti is, usually the better. It's not maybe absolutely required, but it is preferable. And then when you have seclusion of the body, the seclusion of the mind tends to come as a consequence. When you're taken out of that environment, out of the sensual pleasures, out of the noise of the city, gradually your mind lets go of those things, it calms down, and it becomes ready for meditation practice. So that is based on seclusion. Deep meditation happens in seclusion. Based on dispassion, actually fading away is a better translation in this context. This word viraga can mean dispassion, it can also mean fading away, and it's important to distinguish depending on the context. And usually when it goes together with cessation, usually it means fading away, because things fade away and then they cease. This is kind of the natural way of things. As you meditate, things become more and more peaceful, things fade away until eventually they cease and disappear completely. It's part of the same kind of process. And the idea here is that for meditation to become profound, the more things fade away and cease in your perception, in your experience of the world, the more powerful the meditation is going to be. Yeah. What are the things that cease? There are things like the defilements of the mind, they fade away and cease. The body and the five senses, they fade away and cease. Your doing, the activity, the will fades away and cease. It becomes more and more peaceful. Certain feelings fade away and cease, so all you're left with is happiness. Yeah. This is what it means, based on fading away and cessation. The more powerful that fading away and cessation is, the more better it, the more profound your meditation is going to be. And maturing in release means that as you, it can mean two things. It can mean either it matures in a kind of deep samadhi. That is one way of looking at it. When it all comes together, eventually you get into deep samadhi. But more likely, it actually means maturing in the deep insights that mean, like, refer to the final release of the mind from samsaric existence, the maturing in release from suffering, from the defilements once and for all, in other words, becoming an arahant or a stream enterer. That is basically what it refers to as I understand it. So how to practice it? Well, you just have to watch the breath, you have to be in seclusion practicing. That's how it kind of it happens. Number two, yesterday you mentioned the Subha Adimutto, and I looked up the term and found them in a couple of suttas. One of them, which is Majjhima Nikaya 137, the Salyatana Vibhanga Sutta. In all the places, there is only just the mentioning of the term, but not much other info. Could you kindly explain at least the first three vimokas, of which the Subha Adimutto is the third? Also called the directions. Possessed of material form, he sees forms. This is the first one. Not perceiving forms internally, he sees forms externally. This is the second. He's resolved only upon the beautiful. This is the third, the three vimokas. Okay, these are quite specialized things. I don't know how much I would recommend you to investigate or pursue these kind of things, because they are quite unique in the suttas. They're really only found in these kind of formulas. So I'm not sure if I were you, I wouldn't focus too much on these things. But I can explain probably roughly what this means. So possessed of material form, that just means that you possess material form, that's all it means. You part of your person, of who you are, or your perception of the world is material form. So, there is material form. You see forms, and seeing forms, it just means that you see something in your mind's eye. You do a meditation subject, for example, it could be the skeleton, and after a while you see that skeleton in your mind's eye. Or you give rise to the ordinary samadhi nimitta, that is also seeing a form. These things are all called forms. They are forms simply because they have a shape. That's all it means. It's a shape that you see, but you see it in your mind's eye. It's not just the physical eye. So this is the first liberation. So presumably this means taking that meditation quite far, perhaps to the nimitta stage or something like that, so that you have abandoned a certain amount, a number of defilements on the way there. The second one, not perceiving forms internally, you see forms externally. This is the second liberation. This might be that you use, for example, perhaps an object on the first one. It may be an internal object to yourself, like your own skeleton. The other one might be an external limiter, like someone else's skeleton or something like that, some other thing. But still, it is likely to be a mental image, but a mental image or something that appears external to yourself. Something like that. I must admit, I'm not 100% sure now as I say these things, because it is quite specialized, but usually it is relatively straightforward. And then based on that external form, again, you gain a liberation of the mind. Perhaps giving up of a certain number of defilements, perhaps even a jhana state, possibly. And then you have the being resolved upon the beautiful. This is the third, or focusing on the beautiful. And this is usually derived from the metta meditation, where you bring the metta meditation to the point where all the kind of the counterfactors of ill will and all that is completely abandoned. All you have left in your mind is metta, and you have really completely subdued ill will to the point where it cannot arise for a long time afterwards, as if you're taking the metta to its limit, in a sense. The whole world is kind of, the whole world is in your field of metta, and you have a very powerful experience of that. And at that point, you overcome the counter states, which in this case is the ill will and the upset and those kind of things, and they are really subdued very profoundly. So something like that. But again, I wouldn't worry too much about these things, because they are just a particular way of classifying meditation objects. They're only found in these kind of lists, yeah, the eight vimokas. They're not really explained anywhere except for the commentaries. Of course, the commentaries explain them, because that's their job. But it's not something I would be too focused on. Okay. Dear Jambamali, Anapanasati step 9 to 12, does the practitioner need to experience the seven factors of awakening before proceeding to steps 13 to 16? It doesn't need to, because I think that the last steps 13 to 16, they can be used on any object. So those last steps, again, just to remind you, this is the anicca Nupassana, anicca nupassi, contemplation of impermanence, viraga nupassi, the contemplation of fading away, nirodha nupassi, contemplation of cessation, and the patinissaga nupassi, contemplation of relinquishment. This can be contemplated on any object, but it will start to be really powerful once you get to the last steps, 9 to 11, which takes the samatha meditation into samadhi and ideally into the jhana states. So it can be used throughout, and that's why I always recommend you to do just a look back a little bit at the end of your meditation to try to understand the process, what is happening, how does this process happen, and the things that you are likely to see when you review the process is that it works when you just allow things to be, let go. It works when you give rise to certain perceptions, yeah? You remind yourself of, let go of the sensual world because it is suffering, and suddenly it works and something happens. You look at it and you have a certain positive attitude or feeling, and once you review your meditation, you will see how that process works, and that will strengthen your ability to do it again in the future. So this is what I think a good way of learning about meditation. But the deeper the meditation goes, the deeper will be that insight that you have afterwards on how the process works. It can be done, but ideally the meditation is deep before you do these things. Okay, sometimes we're influenced by others, at times unintentionally, to take to heart their negative perceptions of us. Yes, exactly. There is no clarity in the cauldron of emotions, and it's easy to believe in our fault. I know this because I've tried hard to see and interact with the good in another, all the while feeling pain and grief, believing I deserved their harshness. Today you suggest such an approach to be selfish. Well, this is a surprise, a different way to approach such a situation. But perhaps I'm now thinking it's a good one. Thanks for presenting an alternative, as the other way breeds resentment to myself as well, in the end towards another. Should I first remove resentment to myself? Okay. I don't know if I said it was selfish. I think what I meant is that if we focus too much on ourselves and only think about ourselves, it becomes limiting. Yeah, it becomes like a very narrow perception, that self-focus. And ideally, we try to focus differently to kind of reduce that narrow focus on oneself, because it kind of is painful. It's not kind of, that focus in itself is actually painful. And I think sometimes it is useful to try to move away from that. But on the other hand, it's also quite natural. If you live in a situation where you live with people who are giving you a hard time and it's difficult, it is natural that we should feel a bit of, be a bit upset about that and feel it is difficult. So there's no, you know, there's no point in being angry with yourself or upset about yourself or for feeling badly about that situation. That doesn't help at all. Of course, you have to have compassion for yourself as well. And you have to realize that your ability to let go and the ability to have compassion for others is gradual. It takes time. It may never even happen because it's so difficult. So what I was talking about there was really the ideal, something we try to move towards. I was not suggesting that this is easy and it can be done just like that and that you should feel guilty if you can't do it. That would be really counterproductive if that is what happens. Certainly believing that you deserve harshness from others, that is also the wrong way to think about it. Yeah, that is not a very useful way either. So try to get rid of that feeling. Nobody really deserves any kind of harshness. That's not how the world works. It's more like you learn to kind of use your perceptions to kind of develop yourself out of that. So sometimes I would say if you are able to use a difficult situation to your advantage, to grow spiritually, this is, in a sense, that's what I have always found in my own life, and maybe I haven't been kind of under such a harsh kind of conditions before, but whenever I find difficulties in life, I've always tried to kind of see, develop out of that, and ask myself, how can I perceive the situation differently to improve my own good qualities? And I've often found that very useful. When life flows along too smoothly, sometimes you forget to develop properly. Sometimes you need a bit of a shock to the system to kind of get that opportunity. But sometimes it's too hard. Sometimes it's too difficult. Sometimes the situation is so hard that we actually need to leave that relationship or whatever it is, because it's just, you can't be done in certain circumstances. And it's okay, from a Buddhist point of view, to leave difficult relationships. And that is why people join the Sangha, ideally, become a monastic, precisely to have a community of like-minded people where relationships, hopefully, are quite good. It may not always be the case, but sometimes there will be. And that is precisely because you are seeking kalyanamittas, people who influence you in the right way. So it's always useful to move towards people who have a good impact on you and to help you practice the path. If you feel you're deserving someone else's harshness, then probably it means that you are in the wrong place. Because obviously they have had a bad impact on you, because that is not going to be a very useful perception at all. Try to see what you can do with that situation. If it is impossible to leave, if that is not really an option because for whatever reason, then indeed you have to try to somehow have more compassion for yourself, more kindness for yourself. It is not just about kindness for other people, it's also kindness to yourself. Don't think that you deserve the harshness. It's more like, this is the way it is. Now I'm in this situation, and if I can't do anything about it, I have to learn how to deal with it in the most positive way possible. But I would often recommend people to, in situations that are really difficult, sometimes it's just too much. Leave that situation. Find a good counselor, someone who can help you to move away from that. Take this person, maybe you can go together to a counselor to resolve things, if they are willing to do that with you. Do something proactive to kind of move away from that situation. It is not good to be in a situation that is really destructive. So certainly have that amount of compassion for yourself, and never think that you deserve the harshness, because that is a very negative and not a very helpful state of mind at all. Okay, good luck. So let's have a look. The next one. Sir, can you please explain reconditionality? If personality and all actions are preconditioned, where is the doer, the will in our actions? Thank you. The will is always there, yeah, because we are willing all the time. Whenever I pick up one of these questions, I'm willing that, picking it out. That's the will in action. So the will is definitely there. And you know that because you have to will something for anything to happen. So the question is, where does the will come from? That is kind of the interesting point. Is the will conditioned, or is the will somehow independent of conditions? It is hard to know this with certainty through your own experience, but basically the way the Buddha talks about sankhara is the word for will in the suttas, basically says you cannot have things in this way and that way. Sankharas are conditioned. The will is conditioned. And as I mentioned before, there is this experiment in being done recently, been repeated many times, and that is the experiment that shows that the decision, the choice has been made before you feel you make the choice, before you take responsibility for it. The choice is made first, then it feels like you're willing it afterwards. It's kind of weird, isn't it? And they can show that by measuring the potential in the brain, because the choice has a certain potential in the brain, and then they can see that potential arises before it feels like you are making that particular choice. So I think it is it fits fairly well with the modern scientific outlook. I mean, that may not necessarily be an important thing, because it's a bit random sometimes what is the modern scientific outlook, but in this case it seems to be fitting well. If you look at your actions in general, and you look carefully at how you make your choices, you will see, I think, fairly clearly how conditioned they are. They feel free, but very often you know that you do things because of conditions, habits coming from the past. You like certain foods because you've been brought up that way. If you had been brought up in a different country, you would have liked different foods. Exactly the same person, just different conditioning. It is not inherent to you that you like certain foods, for example. So everything is kind of conditioned in this way. The more you look at it, the more clearly that becomes the case. And then you can start to forgive yourself and others in a very deep way. Okay, dear Dharavajan, I feel that there are two or more stages in the practice of compassion. In the first stage, a person would pass compassion to an afflicted persons through meditative practice. In the second stage and the subsequent stages, tangible compassionate support in the form of emotional and material support would be provided. I have a feeling that compassion is the big spring that would give birth to the four rivers of Chaga, Patanisaga, Mutti, and Analeo. Please advise. Thank you, Your Reverence and Metta. Chaga, very often, these are, in other words, the four rivers here talking about the giving up. These are actually the four givings up of the third noble truth, when you kind of give everything up and you give up craving specifically. That's what you are referring to here, presumably. Compassion is a springboard. It is one aspect of the path that you need to develop. It is found specifically in the second factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, right intention. One of those right intentions is abhihinsa, and abhihinsa is basically compassion for people and for other beings. So it is a very important part. You're saying here it leads to the tangible compassion support in the form of material and emotional support of others. That is true, but sometimes the material support of others and helping others, actually sometimes it comes before the development of the compassion in the mind. Because sometimes the development of compassion as a mental object and a powerful samadhi can actually be quite hard. But being helpful, being generous to others, being kind is often much easier. So very often they grow together. You already have some degree of compassion in you. Then you act on that compassion. You act on the kindness. Then that helps you to meditate more. That helps you to be more kind. Very often they have this mutual supportive effect. And then you're kind of, I think, heading in the right direction. And yes, it is possible to take that compassion all the way to the kind of to the end of the path, and to be a very strong support for the deep insights into the practice. That is certainly correct. When the Buddha talks about metta, for example, he often talks about metta first by body and speech, then by mind, and then once it kind of all these things grow together, then you start doing it in meditation practice, and you kind of spread metta to the four directions. But that is the hardest part. Yeah, having metta to the four directions, to the whole world, takes a lot of initial practice to get there. So, and I think that is also partly true with compassion. Often the immediate how we deal with people is often the place to start out. Okay, I hope that makes sense. Dear Ajahn, what does Ali of the end of your name mean? Ali is like, you know, the Muslim name, Ali? Yeah? So, Brahm Ali, Buddhist Muslim, that's what it means. That's the nice way to remember it, yeah? When you remember that, it's easy to remember it. Ali is surprising, because I didn't know that when I, because I chose that name myself. I just saw it in the Theragata. I thought, yeah, that sounds like a good name, so I took that name. But actually, it means exactly the same as Brahma Vangso. Yeah, as a Brahma. Vangso means like lineage, or, you know, that you're part of a broader lineage of Brahmas or whatever it is. Vangsa. Actually, Vangsa means bamboo. So in bamboo, you have these joints, yeah? So it's like a lineage, same kind of idea. Ali means the same thing. It also means lineage. The lineage of Brahma, the family of Brahma. So from that, and you know, the idea to develop the Brahma Viharas, I suppose, is kind of an important point there. But basically it means the same thing as Ajahn Brahma Vangsa, Ajahn Brahma. Kind of, I was surprised that I only found out many years after I got that name, so it was kind of a surprise to me here. Anyway, there you are. So I think one person, I had some strange experiences with my name. There was one fellow I was talking to on the phone, and he asked for my name. I said, Brahmali. He said, what? Bob Marley? That's what he said. He was really happy. He met Bob Marley. Yeah, he was really, whoa, he was really chuffed. Unfortunately, it wasn't Bob Marley. He probably was not so impressed with Buddhist monks, but he would have preferred some reggae musician, I think. Yeah. And another person, he thought my name, I said Brahmali. He said, what? Brahm? Is that the kind of the lower version of Ajahn Brahm? Is that Brahm? Brahmali. And I, anyway, so this is what happens when you have weird names. Do you have any stories about people saying weird stuff about a calico?
So people kept on calling me a calico. And Bhante Sujata got up at a big conference in Sydney and corrected people, saying that Akka is some sort of rust or something dirty, and calico is some sort of hubcap. You can't call him rusty hubcap.
Rusty hubcap.
Something like
that's pretty nice. That's pretty good, isn't it? Okay. Is that inspiring, or is that? I don't. I'm not sure. Is it inspiring? Yeah. Maybe. Yeah. It depends how you look at it, I suppose. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, then there will rusty hubcap. Okay. Okay. Well, we have to polish up that rusty hubcap, you know, having your business. Okay, that's good. Any of the bhikkhunis have any stories about their names that you want to share with share with everyone? Okay, another time. We'll give you another chance. Okay. Okay. Dear Ajahn, allow me to be a smart aleck, okay? To offer a suggestion about the simile of the man jumping into the lily pond. It came to be from a mental image as you were reading the sutta. It is the case about dealing with someone who has a bad mouth but a good heart, like a nagging mother and also a nagging wife. We should be like the man, open our arms to give a big hug and be thankful for all the kindness and good intentions that came from the good heart, while pushing away the abusive words that came with it. I thought this simile is wonderfully expressive. Okay, yeah, maybe that is true, because it is specifically about bad actions and bad speech. So, but maybe we can make it a little bit less gender specific, perhaps, because it can happen from anyone, I suppose. Anyone can say bad things. So, but the general idea, maybe. As for the one about the puddle of water, I think it is about dealing with a different person, with a great difficult person, with a great care not to stir up the bad reaction to the skillful work with whatever little gentleness there is. We cannot afford to be careless with that approach, otherwise we will get a mouthful of mud. So you have to be careful. I suppose that might be another way of looking at it. I think the main point here is the ability to focus on the person. Because that is kind of what the sutta is about, focusing on certain qualities. And so I think that is probably the main, anyway, that's my take on it. But maybe this is an alternative way. Sometimes it's very good to have alternative ways. And I really recommend you to contemplate the suttas for yourself. And that's obviously what you have been doing. You find meaning in them that is relevant for you and really works in your life. And then it becomes far more powerful. One of the problems with, one of the things that you should really do if you're going to teach the Dhamma is you should, instead of kind of trying to deliver wisdom to others, what you should really do is try to encourage people to grow their own wisdom and to kind of see things in their own way. Because it is far more powerful when you see things with your own mind and your own eyes. And suddenly, bang, now I understand it. That is far more powerful than just hearing something from someone else. So really awakening the natural wisdom that is inside everybody is really what I think is the kind of ideal of a teacher. And this is what the Buddha does. He does that through explaining the process of samadhi. And of course, everyone becoming an arahant or a sotapanna or whatever is precisely that. It is awakening the natural wisdom that is already there and waiting to come out. So that is the kind of the ultimate purpose of this. Please continue with that. Please continue reading the suttas in your own way and finding meaning them in your own way. And that is wonderful. And I keep coming back to them. And what you will find is that these suttas open up and meaning keeps coming out. The same simile looks slightly different every time you look at it. New meanings kind of stand out of it. So it's good that you are looking at it in that way. And I really encourage you to continue doing that. Often there isn't one right way of looking at these things. There's a nice sutta in the, where is that now? Somewhere in the Anguttara Nikaya, and there is two lines, and the Buddha has spoken these lines somewhere, I think in the Sutta Nipata or something like that. And then the monks are discussing, what did the Buddha mean by these two lines? And one monk says A, another monk says B, a third monk says C, and there's about four or five different answers. And then they go to the Buddha and they ask, which one of us is correct? What did you actually mean? And the Buddha says, you're all right. It had all of these different meanings. And then the Buddha gives another meaning altogether. So this is the idea. Similes are often very rich and they can be read in many different ways. And for that reason, it is good to actually explore them a little bit. Of course, there are also wrong ways of reading them. It doesn't mean that every way is right, but there may be many right ways of thinking about them. So it's nice to explore these similes. They're actually very rich and very beautiful, so many of these similes. Okay. Good evening, Ajahn. Thank you for clarifying how we should think of the Buddha through his qualities and his teachings. Personally, this has been a struggle. The Dhamma and Sangha are easy to relate to, but I have not always sure how to relate to the Buddha. Since he is fully extinguished, what are we doing when we pay respects to him? Why do some treat his image, Rupa, as if a sacred object? Okay, so the idea of paying respect to the Buddha is a little bit just like remembering him, the memory that there was this, what I would call the world's greatest spiritual genius, the greatest spiritual genius in human history, and that you take that genius as your teacher. So in the present day, you're still kind of, in part, bowing down to that memory, to that person. It's like, if you, let's say you had a father who has passed away, you may still bow down to that father or mother if they were a really good parent. You might bow down out of gratitude, even after they passed away. Isn't that a nice thing to do, to bow down to your parents if they were really good people? You can do that after they pass away. You don't have to stop just because they are dead. Same with the Buddha. The Buddha is like the ultimate parent because it gives you access to the highest insight and happiness. So you bow down to the Buddha even now out of gratitude because you understand what he has kind of passed on 2,500 years later. So the Buddha statue is just a reminder of the Buddha. Yeah, it's just a reminder of those qualities, of that insight, of that kindness, of that generosity that he had 2,500 years ago. And because it reminds you of that, it kind of is a visual aid to bowing down to the Buddha after 2,500 years. That's one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it is just to remember that the Buddha statue represents the qualities of the Buddha. So one way of thinking about it is that you bow down to all those qualities that the Buddha had and that he kind of bequeathed to us afterwards. Yeah, the insight, the wisdom, the samadhi, the compassion, the kindness, all of these beautiful qualities that the Buddha had. And you're bowing down to those qualities. That's also a very nice way of thinking about it. It's really worthwhile bowing down to wisdom, isn't it? It's worthwhile bowing down to compassion and all these qualities, because they are very beautiful qualities. And that, when you bow down to them, what you are doing is you are lifting them up and you are saying, I respect these qualities. And when you respect them like that, you're more likely to develop them as a consequence. So bowing down to something beautiful like that actually is a very powerful way of saying, I respect this. And then you incline your mind towards the development of those things as a consequence. I don't know, bowing can be very beautiful if you do it with a soft heart, you do it in a good way. It is an act of humility, it is an act of trying to aspire for something higher at the same time. There's many good things that come out of bowing. It's very unusual in kind of Western culture to do that. We don't do it that way. But once you get used to it, it feels right. It feels like a kind of part and parcel of the spiritual path to do that. Okay. Dear Ajahn, I am inspired by the presence and the practice of the nuns. Nuns metta chanting every morning has been beneficial to me, very harmonious and peaceful. Do nuns and monks need to join the retreat? No, lots of retreats these days, there is no monks and nuns on the retreats. There are retreats run by lay people, and that's perfectly okay. There's no reason why there has to be monks and nuns. Sometimes we find some very inspiring and knowledgeable lay people, and they can run the retreat. No problem. Does retreat differ from the daily monastic life? I guess Ajahn Akaliko does not have a choice. You mean I have forced him to be? Is that what you mean? I have told him you must be.
My conditioning.
Your conditioning. So. You almost write it akalikol, almost like alcohol, that's all. It's a bit unfortunate. Anyway. So, does it differ from monastic life? It does differ a little bit because, when you are kind of coming here, I guess it depends on what you do, but usually daily monastic life, I don't talk so much during daily monastic life, at least I'm talking from my own position now. Don't talk so much, obviously, and spend more time in my QT. So it's a bit more busy for me being here, because you have to do all of these things, but it's also very nice. It's good to have a bit of change in your life, not always do the same thing. If you always do the same thing, after a while you stagnate a little bit. So taking on new challenges is always very useful. It's quite nice sometimes to come out and lead a retreat or contemplate the suttas and all these kind of things. So it is good, but it is a bit different from ordinary monastic life, I would say. Any comments? No comments?
Back from all of that. Yeah. Okay. Good. Yeah. So, okay. That's good. So it's a chance to kind of just really chill and just really enjoy the retreat. That's great. So in that sense, something similar here. Okay. Last question. I'm just wondering, sequential retreats versus monastic life. Nuns can share their perspective. Okay, so that's good. So we heard a little bit from Upeka already. Sequential retreats versus monastic life. It depends, but I would say that there is much more to monastic life than just being on retreat. Yeah, monastic life is also about having that kind of support around you, having the possibility of living in a kuti. You can, in monastic life, when you go on retreat in monastic life, it is much more retreat than it is here, because you go to your kuti, you stay completely by yourself, maybe for 2 weeks or 6 months in the case of Ajahn Brahm, or whatever it is, and that gives rise to much higher degree of seclusion. And you can, or sometimes, if your meditation is ready, you can actually take it much deeper because of that. Yeah, so this is kind of the advantage. So monastic life has there's much more to it than just kind of being on this kind of retreat. There's also a possibility of greater seclusion, there's possibility of more Dhamma support, because you live in a Dhamma environment and you think about Dhamma much more. You're less distracted from the ordinary things in life. And so there's many, many things going on there. And also, as a monastic, you have a chance of teaching Dhamma, which is also very nice, because when you teach Dhamma, that's often when you learn the most about Dhamma, because you have to look at it in a different way. It is more when you are the kind of the one who teaches, rather than being a passive recipient of the teachings, because you're so actively involved, you actually have to look at the teachings in a different way. So I would say there's lots of benefits from being a monastic that you can't really have just by doing sequential retreats one after the other. Anyway, that's my view of that. But again, people are different, so you have to kind of find out for yourself what is what works for you. Okay, Ajahn, question number one. How does a perfectly enlightened arahant abandon the five hindrances completely? Does that mean he does not yawn or get irritated at all? Does the arahant yawn? A good question. What do you think, Makaliko? Have you seen arahants yawning? Do they yawn?
I can't remember anything.
You can't remember arahants yawning? Okay. Well, is that because of bad memory or because of just...
It's said yawning. Yeah. So
you think it might not, maybe they don't yawn, maybe they just lie down and sleep straight away, so maybe they have stopped yawning, yeah. Yeah. I don't know if they yawn or not. This is outside of my scope of knowledge. They don't get irritated, no, they certainly don't get irritated, that's for sure, because irritation is a manifestation of the second hindrance of ill will. So there's no irritation in the arahant. And this is the whole point of this, is that that is how we know whether someone is an arahant or not, yeah, that they don't have any ill will. If arahants had ill will like everyone else, you wouldn't be able to tell. So this is how you have some idea of someone's degree of purity and practice on the path. If you see defilements in them, there's very good grounds for being uncertain. Maybe you are just imagining defilements where there are none. You don't know sometimes, but there is good grounds for being uncertain if you see defilements, basically. Number two, I sincerely thank you for sharing your understanding of the suttas in such clarity. Maha Sadhu. May I know, how do I differentiate from being skeptical and simply taking things out of a logic view, which is one of the 62 wrong views? I could be wrong, so please kindly enlighten me here. Okay, well, I'm not entirely sure what you are saying here, but... you're asking basically how are you skeptical, or is your skepticism some kind of wrong view? I think that's what you're asking here. skepticism is not really wrong view, because skepticism is just an uncertainty. Yeah, it doesn't mean that you have a fixed opinion at all. It just means you don't know. And it is okay to be skeptical, at least to some extent. If you take something like rebirth, okay, the Buddha taught rebirth, you may accept it. But although you accept it, you don't know it. One thing is accepting it, another thing is knowing it. And knowing it is only when you see it for yourself. So there will be some degree of doubt there until you see it for yourself. Even though it may be a very subtle doubt, there may be some doubt. There may be a tiny degree of skepticism, yeah, because you haven't seen it. That's okay. It should be like that. We shouldn't just take things on board and say it is the absolute truth if we don't know about these things. So I don't think you're coming from the wrong views. It's just that you haven't had enough time, perhaps, to practice these things and to go on with them until... So just keep on going until one day these things become clarified and you actually know what is whether you have more clarity about them. And then skepticism would either increase or decrease. If it increases, you may end up, you know, never coming back again. But if it decreases, then you will come back again in the future and keep on practicing this path. So you know, you don't know what the future is going to bring, so you just kind of carry on like this. Keep on reading the suttas. Keep on listening to what the suttas are about. Keep on practicing. And that skepticism will then change and things will move. And quite likely, the skepticism will get reduced as a consequence. Okay, dear Venerable Ajahn Brahmali, what an insightful and inspirational retreat this is. You seem so enthused, your energy, knowledge and skills to touch us with Dhamma deeply. Much merit to you. Also wanted to mention how kind and considerate retreatants have been, especially the Deva by the name Bianca. Is that Deva present? Not in... Okay. Her energy, kindness and care extends upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths. What a beautiful person, and much merit to her. I have a very strong faith in the Dhamma and leading a wholesome life. Things seem to align effortlessly. I'm very grateful, and I know my spiritual journey will always be supported. Much metta. Okay. Excellent. So that is good. Happy customer. That's always nice. Okay, we'll have a quick look at the remaining questions. Dear Ajahn, of all the great Buddhist places in the world, how did you end up here in Perth? Did you have karmic connection with Ajahn Ram? Thank you for sharing your journey to inspire us. How did I end up here in Perth, of all the great Buddhist places in the world? Actually, Perth is a pretty great Buddhist place, you know. It is not so easy to find great Buddhist places. One of the advantages of being in Perth is that Dhamma happens in English. That is very, very useful. If you go to Thailand or you go to Sri Lanka, then very often teachings happen in Sinhala or Thai, and you have to learn the language. And learning the language, well, you have to learn it really well sometimes to be able to pick out all the subtleties and all the little refined things. It's sometimes much easier to kind of just have it in English. And Bodhinyana Monastery is, in my opinion, a very good monastery. It is not easy to find other monasteries quite like this. There are monasteries that are similar, but anything much better, you have a really hard time finding anything much better, I think. So it's a great place to live your monastic life at Bodhinyana Monastery. You have the seclusion, you have a good teacher, you have access to the suttas, you have a lot of really good things happening at this monastery here. Do I have a karmic connection with Ajahn Brahm? Maybe. Yeah. What happened, I was staying at the monasteries in the UK for a while. I was in Anagarika over there for about a year and a half. And then I heard one talk by Ajahn Brahm, and I said, that's my teacher. And I called up Ajahn Brahm and said, can I come to Perth? He said, yes, I came to Perth. That was it. Been here ever since. Does that mean I have a karmic connection? Maybe. Yeah. Who knows? Some kind of connection, perhaps. Anyway. It somehow seems to work out that way. Very hard to say. It's just a bit random, isn't it? You do things somehow work out, and then when you look back in time, it kind of looks like there was a plan or something. But when you look forward, it all seems very random and very kind of dodgy. So I think that often that when we look back and we see a plan, I think often we are imposing a plan upon the random reality that actually of things happening. Or maybe, yeah, I don't know. Is it random? It's not that random. Who knows? Anyway, next one. To the Kalyanamitta, asking about being born without the senses last night. My olfactory nerve was severed 8 years ago, and I completely lost my sense of taste and smell. Yes, it helps in the initial stages of meditation, and there are less opportunities for craving, aversion, attachment. However, I still crave to experience what others describe, like our beautiful dana food or the smell of rain on the hot concrete. Craving eternally unsatiated. Having had the opportunity to experience the pasa, vedana, tanna, upadana, and dukkha associated with them, and seeing the cessation has been insightful, but I would say it is better to be born with all your senses and to learn to live above them. Better still, don't get reborn. There are no shortcuts. Less thinking, more practice. Ajeva kitsang. Kitsam Atapang. Today, just today, the work Atapang must be. What is I was trying to say there? Today, the work must be done, or something like that. Don't forget to think of the disadvantages, like not being able to smell if the house is on fire, or if I've stepped in the dog poo. Think of the dukkha. That is true. Thank you, Ajahn, for passing on. I hope that was okay. It is okay, and I think you're basically on the right track. It is not usually helpful to just cut off the senses. You have to deal with them, because the desires are really the problem, and the desires will be there. Of course, if you had been born without taste and smell, then of course you wouldn't have that craving. It is because it was cut off while you already had them. That's why the craving remains. But that craving will just be passed on to the other senses anyway. So even if you haven't got any sense of smell and taste, you will still crave. So the problem is still exactly the same. Okay, this is a message. I love you. Okay. I hope that is a kind of dummy kind of love. Yeah. So the metta, the good metta love. So that's very, very nice. Okay. Excellent. Okay. Let's move on to the next one. Dear Venerable Brahmali, I would like to thank you for all the effort and having kindness, loving kindness you have put into guiding us on this retreat. Thank you for your kindness and wisdom in guiding us through the wonderful word of the Buddha. May you be happy and live a long life in good health and joy. Thank you. What a great blessing you are to the world. Really, okay. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, that is a very kindly message. That's good. I'm just glad that people are getting something out of this retreat. It's always a very positive and nice thing here. Okay, I'm going to finish off the questions. It's going to take a little bit longer. So if you want to leave anything like that, please feel free to do so. There's absolutely no need to sit here if you need to go or whatever, or you want to go or whatever it is. Dear Ajahn, as I see it, your views and comments on some of the suttas are quite contrary to the traditional Theravada ways. My question is, when you visit those countries, do you experience any unpleasantries? Thank you, Ajahn. Not really. Usually people are quite open-minded. I'm always surprised, because sometimes I say things like the Abhidhamma is not the word of the Buddha, and I say that because I think it is important to be honest about these things, because to me it is just so obvious that is the case. And some people don't like that, but usually they just accept it, they don't kind of make a fuss out of it, whereas other people, it makes them look into these things more carefully, and maybe they will come to a similar kind of view. So I think it is important to be open about things and say things. If we never say anything, we tend to stagnate, we just kind of get left in the kind of the rut sometimes. Usually the answer is that it is usually well received and usually not a problem, even though I do tend to express how I think, what is the most likely interpretation of some of these suttas. I try not to be too controversial. I try not to be controversial for the sake of being controversial. I try to do it simply because I think it is useful to straighten out things that where people might go wrong. Yeah, and it might be a hindrance to their practice or development or whatever. Sometimes I think it is useful to point that out so people don't get stuck in certain ways. It obviously depends a little bit on the situation. If you know that you are in company of someone who you know has very different views from you, especially if it might be a very senior monk, then you try to be a bit careful and gentle, and you don't kind of just blurt things out when you know it might be problematic. So you are sensitive to the situation as well. Otherwise, it causes all kind of problems as a consequence. Okay. Azan, can you say more about how the eye contact with another person asserts our ego? Thank you. I think it's just about when you feel yourself, when you look at someone else, you kind of become more self-conscious. You know that you are there. If you just kind of walk around in the daily life and without anyone being around, it's almost as if you forget yourself after a while. You forget about what you look like. If you have to go out to work or whatever, you kind of have to look at yourself in the mirror in the morning to make sure you look right, your clothes are about right, and all of that. So you become more self-conscious about yourself. But after a while, if you don't look at anyone and nobody really looks at you and you don't really you don't feel any self-consciousness around other people, after a while you kind of forget about yourself. You just wander around in your baggy clothes, kind of comfortable for the meditation retreat, and you kind of stop to really think about others. As soon as you look someone in the eye, it always creates a lot of more information there. When I give a Dhamma talk, I don't usually look so much at the people in the audience, because if I look too much, it also is distracting from your train of thought. It's more difficult to kind of give a kind of continuous talk if you look too much at other people. There's so much information going on, yeah? You look someone in the eye, it's like information, a lot of information going on. And this is kind of the point of looking someone in the eyes, to get a feel for other people, for who they are, where they're at, how they are thinking, and all these kind of things. But that also means a lot of information and makes it harder to give a talk. Traditionally, when people give a talk, they will often have a fan in front of them, yeah, like a shield, so they can't, there's no eye contact at all between the audience and the teacher. It's kind of a traditional way of doing things. And very often talks are given with eyes closed. Yeah, you close your eyes. That's how Adam Brahm normally gives talks at Bodhinanda Monastery. And everyone closes their eyes and you focus 100% on the meaning rather than getting all that visual input that often gets in the way of being able to take everything fully on board. Okay. Dear Ajahn, I have been very fortunate to attain all the past Sutta retreats. All are best. This is the best of the best. Okay. Wow. Okay. That's really wonderful. Adam, thank you very much for giving us the deep and great teaching, which is very useful for our practice. Very inspiring. Feels like I'm sitting in front of an arahant. Okay. Are you, Adam? Arahantship is very, very profound, so the chances of meeting an arahant are really slim, unfortunately. If not, very, very soon. I would like to offer you beautiful flowers of gratitude which bloomed in the bottom of my humble heart at your feet. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Well, that's really wonderful. What can I say? I'm not sure what to say to all of that. That's really, really marvelous. Same time, my heartfelt thanks for Bianca, Christina, Scotty, and Leha, and all who have involved in organizing this retreat. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, what a wonderful message. Great. Wonderful. Excellent. Sublime. Two more questions for tonight, and then we are done for this evening. Dear Ajahn, with regard to the relinquishment of attachments, I find something I cannot understand in the Anguttara Nikaya 9.36. Among the list of the worldly attachments is the lust for the Dhamma, the sutta says, but if it does not attain destruction of the tanks because of that lust for the Dhamma, because of the delight in the Dhamma, then another disturbing point about this statement of the need to give up the Dhamma is that it also implies the giving up of all forms of knowledge, if Dhamma is the highest form of knowledge. This means a poor simpleton who has no love for any kind of knowledge would have an advantage over a well-learned professor in getting awakened. It seems unfair to me. Okay, so the point here is, first of all, the word lust is not a very good word there. It really means like a kind of wholesome desire for it. Would have been better to translate it like that. The reason why it is translated as lust is because a translator like Bhikkhu Bodhi, he has a certain scheme. He translates certain words consistently in certain ways, and sometimes it becomes really awkward. Like here, lust for the Dhamma is kind of strange. So some kind of desire for the Dhamma, some kind of inclination, inspiration about the Dhamma is really what it means. The other word, the delight in the Dhamma, is a more appropriate word. So what exactly does it mean in this particular context? And it means that you have some sort of delight in that experience that you are having. You haven't been able to let go of all the delight, for example, in the state of samadhi that you had. Or you even have some delight in that insight that you have been acquiring, that particular state of insight. So you're not able to let go 100%. There's a little bit of holding on left going on there. In this case, it doesn't necessarily have anything to do with the teaching as such. It has more likely to do with the actual state that you have attained, and you have some holding on to that state. That is what I think is more likely to be happening here. It does not really imply giving up all forms of knowledge. You still have the I don't think it implies that. Knowledge can often be useful if it is applied well on the spiritual path. To have a good understanding of things, look at someone like Ajahn Brahm. He was one of the most knowledgeable of the monks, early monks in Thailand. He studied Pali, he was read the Vinaya in great detail. He had a good understanding of what was going on in terms of Dhamma. And he was also one of the best meditators. So knowledge and meditation, very often they can go hand in hand if it is used skillfully. And then you can practice the suttas and practice the path in the right way. And it also enables you in the future to give better Dhamma talks, because you have a good foundation in the teachings of the Buddha. It enables you to teach the Dhamma in a way that actually reflects how the Buddha taught. One of the problems is if you teach very idiosyncratic teachings, sometimes it is hard to really know how good those teachings are. How well they reflect reality, how easy it is for other people to comprehend. And sometimes it is better to use a similar kind of language as the Buddha. Use the categories the Buddha uses, 5 khandhas, 5 hindrances, that kind of stuff, so that you kind of make sure that you align what you say with how the Buddha spoke, so that the Dhamma doesn't get lost too quickly. Then it is more likely you will get the message across in a good way. So I agree with you. A degree of knowledge is always good, but it's not necessary. And this is also one of the beautiful things about the Dhamma, is you can be a fairly simple person in terms of education and background and knowledge. You don't have to be some kind of cosmopolitan, kind of super educated PhD to be able to practice the Dhamma. You can be quite a simple person, and you can still gain these insights. And this is the beautiful thing about this teaching. It puts everyone in many ways on an equal level, because the insight will be the same regardless of where you're at. If you have a good heart, you practice with integrity, you have a natural feeling for the Dhamma, you're going to go on a long way on this path regardless of your knowledge and educational background and all of these kind of things. That is what is so nice about it. You look at the time of the Buddha, there were some of the monks and nuns, they were very simple people, whereas others were really very highly educated people, people from the low caste, people from the high castes, everyone coming together. And the Buddha, of course, he abolished the whole idea of caste distinction within the Sangha. So we stop measuring each other by how we were born, the social background that we have, and instead the measure has more to do with virtue and how we live our lives. If there is any measure, that is where it should be. Okay. Dear Ajahn, how can mindfulness be caused to be more stable and deeper with metta? Okay, so again, what you have to do is you have to come back to the causes of mindfulness. And as I have said from the start point, is that the causes of mindfulness are really two things. They are sila and ujjukha ditti. So always, if you want to have a better ability and you want to improve your mindfulness, always come back to your sila. Ask yourself whether you can live even better. No doubt you are living very well already. I have no doubt about that. But always we can improve even further. Ask yourself how you can have more kindness in your life. Ask yourself how you can be more generous. Ask yourself how you can do these things on a moment-to-moment basis again and again and again. And as you do that, as you purify yourself in this way, your mindfulness will arise as a consequence. It will arise because you will feel good about yourself. You will have not even a smidgen of remorse or regret of what you've been doing. And because of that, you feel happy about your conduct, you feel that you're living life well. And when you feel happy about yourself, mindfulness is natural, because the present moment is also pleasant and happy place to be here. And also you give up some of the coarser desires and ill will. And these are things that by the very nature take you out of the present moment. So again, you're increasing your ability to be mindful as a consequence. Then remember the right view. And one of the most important things of the right view is the disadvantage in the sensual world. Why the sensual world is so problematic? Come back to some of the similes maybe I was reading out today. Remind yourself of how impermanent everything is. Every time you turn on the TV and you see some event in the world, remember, this is the sensual world. What you're seeing on that TV is the sensual world going wrong, especially when you see the news. And it goes wrong all the time. Every time you get disappointed with how the world goes, you remind yourself, this is because the sensual world is out of control. So just think like this, and remind yourself, bring up this idea of right view, develop it over time, again and again and again. Be kind, be gentle, do the right thing. And as you do this consistently over long periods of time, your meditation, your mindfulness, everything will come together as a consequence. It is often not the quantity of meditation that matters the most, because the quantity of meditation is good if you are kind of doing really well and you're heading in the right direction. Often these supports are often more important to focus on than the number of hours that you actually sit. But it's good to do a retreat every now and again, because it gives you more of a chance to deepen your practice and to take stock of how your spiritual life is going in general. Okay, so that is all for tonight. So have another good night, a good night's rest, and we'll see you again tomorrow morning here.